Mogadishu and Minneapolis mourn today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A truck bomb in the Somali capital killed hundreds of people, and in Minneapolis, the Somali-American community mourns a man lost in that blast.
Every morning I see him in a prayer, and he would greet me with a big smile on his face, one of our pillars in our community.
Plus, Kurds and Iraqis work together to fight ISIS. Now the two sides are fighting each other.
I wonder why in Iraq, before they have finished one war, they launch another one.
And why movies got facelifts in post-war Germany.
The country was still traumatized by defeat, and some German politicians and others in positions of power, they figured the best way to get over the trauma is to just ignore it.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Thank you for being here today. Over the years, a trend in Somalia seems to have been a couple of steps forward, then some violent event, and a step back. What happened over the weekend in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, feels like several steps back, a bombing that killed hundreds of people. The Somali government is blaming it on the Al-Qaeda offshoot Al-Shabaab. The explosion affected not just Somalis there, but Somalis in the diaspora in places like Minnesota. We'll hear more in a moment about Ahmed Iyo, a Somali man from Bloomington, Minnesota, who was killed in the blast. First, though, we turn to another Somali-American from Minnesota who happened to be in Mogadishu on Saturday and was minutes away from the site of the bombing when it happened. Jibril Ofiare is president of the Twin Cities Somali-American Citizens League. Just before I spoke with him, he learned that some of his relatives had been killed in the explosion.
My uncle, who was a U.S. citizen from Virginia, he had lived here, came back to Somalia, Mogadishu, for the last 20 years and wanted to serve and give back to his community. And now his wife and a cousin of mine who had worked to the Ministry of Commerce and International Affairs, and also a fellow Minnesotan, a U.S. citizen, who I was supposed to be seeing him right before the blast. And a lot of activists, a lot of young folks that was the promise of this country. When I came here a week and 8 days ago, I saw Somalia, especially in Mogadishu, who's had made a lot of tremendous progress in terms of security, economically and education. Everywhere you go, people were jubilant and optimistic. But this tremendous and horrific event had really shaken our core and set us back a little bit.
Yeah, undoubtedly a lot of people are affected by the hundreds of people who died, like you. Now, you were very close to this explosion when it happened. Can you tell us where you were?
I was a place called Kilometer 4, where the attack had taken place. It's called Kilometer 5. I was in a car heading to meet my relatives. So I was a couple blocks, basically, away from it, and this was a very powerful, unheard-of bombing.
Jibril, it sounds like it was a matter of minutes, perhaps, and it could have been you.
Absolutely. Could have been me. So that's why I have been really, really sorrow and mourning for the last few days, and it's just... it's just too much, too much.
How are hospitals in Mogadishu coping?
They're coping barely. Such a magnitude attack, they cannot bear it. This is huge. This is beyond the capability of the doctors, beyond the capability of the first responders. And that's why I have taken upon to encourage myself and whoever would listen to me to donate a blood. And luckily, the type of blood I was able to give was the one that was most needed. And I'm about to go out to one of the hospitals and help the injured. There's a lot that needs to be done. And whoever is out there, if you're in Mogadishu, or if you're a diaspora, please, or non-Somalis, go to the hospitals. Help the injured. You're needed.
Jibril, I understand that you were visiting Mogadishu, and actually you were supposed to have gone home already, but decided to postpone your trip. Can you Tell us what you were doing back in Mogadishu and why you decided to stay a few more days.
I came here to attend a conference that the government had put together, primarily the constitution rebuilding, and I also came here to help a couple of universities to partner them to the couple of universities in Minneapolis to kind of rebuild the country. So my stay had really gone beyond what I've intended to spend here, and I've decided to stay behind and do whatever I can. I could not leave my fellow citizens like this.
Jibril, I know there's a lot of communication between your community in Minnesota and Mogadishu. What are you hearing today that you're in Mogadishu from the people in Minnesota, in Minneapolis especially?
Well, because of the death of one of our fellow Minnesotans, it really touched in Minnesota. It touched because of one of our colleagues who has been killed. But Minnesota has a special connection to Somalia. It has the largest Somali diaspora outside of Mogadishu. So therefore, we have a lot of stake and a lot of investment to our homeland for the betterment and in Somalia. So there are a lot of people who had contacted me, and they were still up due to the time differences, and they're mourning with us, and they're sharing the pain that's going on right now.
Jibril Afiare, a Somali-American from Minnesota who finds himself today in Mogadishu. We send you our condolences and our condolences to all the people of Mogadishu. Jibril, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Ahmed Abdikarin Iyo is the name of that man from Minnesota who was visiting Mogadishu and died in the blast yesterday. Mohammed Omar is the executive director of Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota. That's the mosque that Abdikarin Iyo attended. Mohammed Omar, first of all, our condolences to you and to all of the members of the masjid there in Bloomington. Could you tell us a little bit about Ahmed Iyo? What was he like? What was he doing in Mogadishu?
Mr. Iyo, he was one of our effective and active community members here. And every morning I see him in the prayer and would, you know, greet me with a big smile on his face. As he came to the United States, I think 1998, he started working hard and establishing his family. And he also didn't only work, but also he was continuing his education when he came from Somalia, that he started learning and catching up the language and assigned himself to one of the community colleges here. And after he worked hard, he graduated 2016 with a bachelor's degree. And then he, you know, immediately enrolled himself to a master's degree. And his hope was to go back and contribute to the stability of Somalia and, you know, and the home country that he came from, and try to give with the education and the experience he got from Minnesota. And that is the motive that he had all this time. And he would ask you every morning or every now and then, you know, he would tell you something about, you know, good thing happening in Somalia or, you know, some sad news from Somalia. And when he was going there, he heard an opportunity that he may get a job from the United Nations. I think one of the positions got open and he wanted to apply. Just a quick trip. Last time we heard, he, you know, checked in his hotel, the bomb went off and the tragic, you know, incident happened. We lost him.
His family also attends Dar al-Farouk Mosque. Have you spoken with them and how are they coping?
I was with them almost the last, you know, I think yesterday.
And, yeah.
I was with the kids and they're going through a tough time. I mean, you know, even Sister Roon, the wife of Ahmed, was very skeptical for him going back to Somalia, and she was like, please don't go there, at least, you know, just let us wait a few more years and all this. I mean, Sister Roon, Ahmed was the only one in his family who was working, and that's why we started, you know, immediately a GoFundMe page, and we're trying to cover some expenses as they are going through these difficult times.
You know, some immigrant communities in the U.S. are so tightly knit. Can you just give us a sense of how the loss of one man, really a key figure, it seems, in that community there in Minneapolis, how that sends ripples across the community in Minneapolis and what it does to people's psyches?
As a community, we are like blocks, you know, holding each other. So when we lose one member of the community, it feels like, you know, the whole, there is a hole in the block. So this man was, he wasn't only a, you know, a father for his family, but also he was one of our most active community figure that we have here. And also he was one of the support that his family back Somalia that they had in here. So he was holding many, you know, positions at the same time. And the loss of this man would take time for the community to recover because, you know, this was a man that he saw himself that he would make difference in the lives back home. And also he was holding a very, you know, huge responsibility in here. And the community would definitely feel him as a big tragedy and a big loss.
Finally, I've seen comments on social media from many people, and not just Somalis or Somali Americans, that this attack, which killed over 300 people, did not get the kind of attention in the media that such a tragedy and loss of life deserves. Has this been discussed in Minneapolis?
I mean, yes. The media usually, if this would be a different country, or especially what they call it, not the third world, it would have picked up a big attention from the media. But, you know, what I see right now is we need to speak up as a community. We need to make this noise that our community needs attention. And that's why the reason why I'm giving my time to whoever reached me out as a community leader. I'm here to make my voice heard.
Well, we certainly appreciate your time today, Mohammed Omar. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye.
Before the break, just a moment to mention another hurricane as Puerto Rico continues to recover from Hurricane Maria. What was left of Hurricane Ophelia hit Ireland today. The storm weakened before coming ashore, but still delivered hurricane-strength winds that toppled trees and left thousands of homes without power. We're also getting reports of fatalities. Now, tropical storms don't often make it all the way to Europe with high velocity and wind power, but it does happen from time to time. By coincidence, today is the 30th anniversary of what most people in England call the Great Storm of 1987. Forecasting was not as accurate as it is today. And the evening before the storm hit 30 years ago, this is what one forecaster told anxious BBC viewers.
Earlier on today, apparently, a woman rang the BBC and said she heard that there was a hurricane on the way. Well, if you're watching, don't worry, there isn't. But having said that, actually, the weather will become very windy. But most of the strong winds, incidentally, will be down over Spain and across into France.
That was weatherman Michael Fish. The storm turned out to be much more powerful than he predicted. It killed at least 18 people and brought down literally millions of trees throughout the country. Fish has had to live with that for three decades now, and he's still defensive about it.
Well, no, it's very unjust, really. It's a case of shooting the messenger, in a way, because myself and Bill Giles, who was on after me and just made the remark it would be a little bit breezy up the channel, both of us, of course, were the mouthpiece of the computer. And if you're going to blame anybody or anything, then it has to be that. We had no input into the forecast whatsoever. We were just presenters, in a way.
Veteran meteorologist Michael Fish there, speaking with our friends at the BBC last week. Coming up after the break, why German movie fans would rather hear Leonardo DiCaprio say, "Ich bin König der Welt," instead of, "I am king of the world." You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is Oscar season. Okay, it's the very beginning of Oscar deliberation season. The deadline closed this month for the Foreign Language Academy Award submissions, and the number this year, 92 foreign films. That is a record. It's also a lot of subtitles. Patrick Cox is here. He's with The World in Words, our podcast on language. So, Patrick, some movies get dubbed, some get subtitled. What's your preference?
Well, I got to say, I prefer subtitles. And to be honest, it seems like most people do, because unless it's like a Japanese monster movie, it's not going to be dubbed.
I prefer subtitles.
But if you live in certain parts of the world, you don't have a choice. You get dubbing or pretty much nothing. Huh. Many countries have, you know, decided to go that route. One of which is Germany, which has, over time, it's built up this incredibly sophisticated dubbing industry. You want a little quiz?
Yeah. I suspect I'm going to hear some German.
This is an American TV show. Let me play it for you first in German.
Ich habe mich immer schon gern gewaschen. Ich habe gern gebadet. Ich habe gern geduscht.
All right, I'm drawing a blank here, because if this song by the Staple Singers is a song here on an American TV show, I'm obviously not watching it. I think I probably should, because I love the Staples.
So let me play you the original.
I've always loved getting clean. I love baths. I love showers.
Is this Orange Is the New Black? Yeah, because you don't get many showers in prison.
You got it quicker than I did. Yeah, Orange Is the New Black.
I often fail these quizzes you give me, Patrick, so I'm happy. So how did this happen that Germans skip the subtitles and dub everything?
Well, that's a question that Veronica Zaragovia had. She's an American reporter based in Berlin. And she just started interviewing people in the industry, directors, actors, people who specialize only in dubbing. This is what they do all day long. You know, Germans were dubbing their movies for all kinds of reasons. At first, it was to create jobs. Then the Nazis came along. They wanted to manipulate the messages of movies. And as Veronica told me in the podcast, this kind of deception through dubbing, it continued after the war.
The country was still traumatized by defeat and, of course, revelations of Nazi atrocities. And some German politicians and others in positions of power, they figured the best way to get over the trauma is to just ignore it. I talked with Rolf Aurich about this. He's with the Deutsche Kinemathek. It's a museum for film and TV here in Berlin. And he told me it was pretty common to change the plots of foreign movies, especially war movies. Casablanca, for example, that was made in 1942, but it wasn't released in Germany until 1952.
Frühen 50er Jahren in Westdeutschland ins Kino gekommen ist.
Aurich says viewers didn't even know that Nazis had anything to do with the plot. Like in the dub version, the Czech resistance fighter Victor Laszlo, he becomes Victor Larsen, a Norwegian scientist. And there's no Nazi officer chasing him as in the original film, no Nazis at all.
Das finde ich so interessant gerade, weil es natürlich auch ein besonderes Licht.
Aurich says these storyline changes reveal an alternative Germany of the 1950s, a country that was still not able to confront its Nazi past. It wasn't until 1975 that West Germany released a dubbed version of Casablanca that stuck to the original plot.
Oder möchten Sie morgen nach Lissabon abreisen? Unter einer Bedingung?
Und die wäre?
Sie kennen die Führer der Untergrundbewegungen in Paris, in Prag, in Brüssel, in Amsterdam, in Oslo, in Belgrad, in Athen.
Sogar in Berlin.
Ja, sogar in Berlin.
In 1990, after the two Germanys reunified, the tone changed. Dubbed films and TV shows were full of references to Nazis, some serious, some funny. When Seinfeld was dubbed to German in the 1990s, they left the soup Nazi in it.
Bestellverfahren. Alle Leute nennen ihn insgeheim den Suppen-Nazi.
Wieso? Was
also in the 90s came Hogan's Heroes, that old American sitcom about Allied prisoners in a German POW camp. The show had run in the U.S. from 1965 to 1971, but the first dubbed version in Germany only arrived in 1992. Viewers ignored that one until a really successful voice actor and producer, Rainer Brandt, was hired to redub it. And it was broadcast again and retitled Ein Käfig voller Helden, or A Cage Full of Heroes. The Germans, of course, are depicted as inept losers, but German audiences loved it.
Und da habe ich gedacht, in Amerika hast du die arbeiten viel mit ihrem mit dem Akzent.
In this video interview on a site called Retro TV, Brandt says he figured if Americans have such a mix of accents, why not mix up different German accents in the show? It would be easier that way to caricature the German officers running the POW camp.
Und so haben wir die ganzen Dinger dann gemacht und dann dementsprechend die Texte völlig verändert.
Brandt says in one episode, the Germans are planning to drop bombs on London. But in this dubbed version, he adds a joke. They talk about dropping condoms instead of bombs as a little birth control method to stop the Brits from multiplying. And then there was Heil Hitler.
This is General von Himmelberger of the Führerstaff. Heil Hitler!
Heil Hitler!
Brandt, of course, didn't need to translate this. It was in German already. But instead of saying Heil Hitler, his characters often say totally absurd things, like, this is how high the cornflowers grow.
Heil Kräuter!
Heil Kräuter!
Guten Tag, ich bin Oberführer Heilsdorf, Heil Schnitzler!
Heil Schnitzler, or something else equally ridiculous.
Heil Lilly!
Heil Hitler!
In Ordnung!
Heil Hitler! Nur freilich, was denn sonst?
It's a great example of how Germans view dubbing as an art form. And it's not just about adding jokes. The lip-syncing is taken much more seriously here, too. So it's not surprising to hear a comment like this.
If you want to do it good, it will be a complete piece of art again afterwards.
This is Clemens Frohmann. He's a dubbing director who's based here in Berlin. He directed the dubbing of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Silence, about 17th century Portuguese missionaries in Japan. He and his colleagues went to look for Japanese actors all over Germany because they wanted them to do the dubbing so that they speak German with an accent, just like you have actors in the original version speaking English with a Japanese accent.
Und der Herr sprach zu ihnen, geht hin in alle Welt und prediget das Evangelium aller Kreatur.
Sometimes the original film director will check out the German version and give feedback. Woody Allen, for example, he had the same German voice dub his parts for years.
Kann ich Sie mit einem Kaugummi erfreuen?
Ach, lieber nicht. Nee, nicht so. Nein. Achten Sie lieber auf den Verkehr. Ach,
this is from Annie Hall. The German title was Der Stadt Neurotiker, or The City Neurotic. Woody Allen liked his German voice doppelganger until recently.
And then he did To Rome with Love. That was a movie where he acted, after a longer time, acted again himself, not just directed. And we did the trailer. And he sent back the trailer and said, well, I think I'm afraid you have to change my voice. He's getting too old now.
What a story. So Woody Allen outlives his German voice doppelganger. Incredible. That's a Mobius strip of a story if ever there was one. You can hear more of Veronica Zaragovia's story about the German love affair with dubbing in the latest World in Words podcast. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts or at pri.org/language. Patrick Cox of the World in Words, thanks for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
News headlines are coming up in 1 minute right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Another European country takes a turn to the right. This time it's Austria, and the country looks set to get a young, charismatic, and very conservative new leader.
Now it's harder to see where the boundary is between the right and the very far right.
That story's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In the all-important fight against ISIS militants in Iraq, the U.S. has had two key allies, the Iraqi government and Kurdish forces. Today, those two were on opposite sides as Iraqi troops took control from the Kurds of the contested city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq.
They captured major government buildings, they captured a major military base, the airport, and major oil facilities.
That's The World's Rich Hall in Beirut. He's been watching the military operation, which came just about a month after Iraq's Kurdistan region held an independence referendum.
In many ways, this is a response to that referendum, but the issue of Kirkuk itself has been a flashpoint for decades, actually. And depending on who you ask, it goes back either to World War I or back to Saddam Hussein's era. Kirkuk is historically a Kurdish-majority city, and when Saddam Hussein came to power, he forced the Kurds out of Kirkuk, and many areas, in fact. It was called the Arabization Program. He wanted to move Kurds out and put Arabs in there. And then when ISIS came to Kirkuk and invaded many areas of Iraq, the Iraqi army fled Kirkuk, and the Peshmerga, the Kurdish Peshmerga, moved in. And they saw this as righting a historic wrong. And you can get a sense for the importance Kurds attach to Kirkuk by its nickname. They're given the nickname the Jerusalem of Kurdistan.
So there's this decades-old tension between Baghdad and the Kurds in the north. But we've also got to mention oil, too. I mean, this matters a lot to Baghdad.
Yes, this always comes up in this part of the world. Kirkuk lies on a sea of oil. There are six major oil fields in the Kirkuk region, and they provide around 350,000 barrels of oil a day. And the Kurdistan region needs that to survive economically. And the Iraqi government can't afford to lose it either.
So the Iraqi National Army goes in, but what we're hearing is reports that suggest the Kurds essentially folded without any major skirmishes. What have you heard?
So yeah, this is where you get into the murky world of intra-Kurdish politics. There's a big rivalry in Iraqi Kurdistan between the PUK and the KDP. They historically differ on major issues. And there was a suggestion that one side cut a deal with the Iraqi government to let them in. There's been some rumors that the Peshmerga is preparing a counterattack, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon, especially when the U.S. is supporting, in so many words, the reassertion of federal control over these disputed areas. And Iran and Turkey and all of Kurdistan's neighbors are supporting the move as well.
Yeah, the interesting thing here, though, and I'd love to know what the U.S. thinks about this, is that the U.S. is supporting, militarily speaking, Iraqi government troops and the Kurdish forces. And they both receive U.S. weapons and training. What is the U.S. position about all of this?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch this develop over the last few days. So there's been some speculation that the U.S. has kind of dropped the ball on this in some way. So the U.S. has been kind of very narrowly focused on defeating ISIS, and it's been giving the Kurdish forces and the Iraqi government weapons and training to do this. But it hasn't really been planning for what comes next. And that might sound familiar for people who have paid attention to the Iraq war before. There was this lack of post-war planning. There was even this remarkable report in Bloomberg that suggested Rex Tillerson had come up with terms to persuade the Kurds to postpone the referendum, which would have avoided all this fighting, but he delivered the letter too late.
Wow.
But since fighting began, the U.S. has been trying to calm these two allies. I spoke to Michael Knights from the Washington Institute, who has been covering the Kurdistan region and Iraq since the 90s. He has great sources on this, and this is what he told me about what the U.S. has been doing.
The U.S. has been highly involved. I mean, the lights have been burning in the State Department and the National Security Council all the way through the last week, including the weekend. We've seen the presidential envoy, Brett McGurk, in Baghdad. He's going to go to Erbil next.
So where does this leave the Kurdish independence bid? Has it crushed it once and for all? And if war is an eventual outcome of the bid for independence, would the Kurds be happy to let independence go in the interest of peace?
I think it deals quite a substantial blow to the idea of an independent Kurdistan, at least in the very near future. The Kurdistan regional government relies on oil sales for, I think, 90% of its revenues. More than half of that revenue comes from the Kirkuk oil fields. So it's hard to see how an independent Kurdistan would be economically viable without Kirkuk. People just say it wouldn't work. And again, how would they do this without the support of the U.S.? I think President Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan region, took a gamble. He saw that Iraq was weakened after ISIS. He saw that the Kurds had this great support from the international community. They built up support by fighting ISIS. And he took a gamble that this was the right time. And it doesn't seem to have paid off. And it's difficult to see where things will go from here.
The world's Rich Hall in Beirut. Thanks very much for your time today, Rich.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
For the Kurdish view now, let's turn to Ayub Nuri, who used to work for The World in Baghdad. Nuri is now the English editor of the Kurdish news service Rudao. He's also the author of Being Kurdish in a Hostile World. Ayub joins us from Toronto on his way back to Erbil, where he was just a little less than 2 weeks ago. Ayub, it seems that forces loyal to the Iraqi government have taken control of Kirkuk. That ends years of Kurdish control there. There are some reports that one Kurdish party, the PUK, may have cut a deal with the government in Baghdad. Are you hearing the same thing, and what kind of deal would that be?
In almost every Facebook post and Twitter feed that I check from friends or other sources or colleagues who are on the ground at the moment, I see exactly that report, that some Peshmerga commanders affiliated with the PUK, which has good relations with Baghdad, had basically ordered their soldiers to abandon their posts and not to fire on the advancing Iraqi troops and advancing Iraqi militia. That is what has facilitated the capture of Kirkuk. That's what I get. But unfortunately, there is a lot of blame game going on at the moment in the Kurdistan region. PUK says the KDP is running away. The KDP says, no, the PUK abandoned their posts. A lot of blame game, and it will take many months or probably even years for us to know what the reality was. The reality is that, I mean, the fact on the ground, Kirkuk, a city that the Kurds have been claiming to be their own, the Iraqis have been claiming to be their own for decades and decades, today fell to the Iraqi army and Iraqi militia.
So a lot of blame game, also a lot of propaganda. If those reports of some deal cut with the government in Baghdad turn out to be true, how would you feel about that?
I feel really, really frustrated and really, really sad. I'm not speaking as a Kurd saying a Kurdish city fell to the Iraqi army. I'm frustrated because I've been covering the ISIS war for 2 years on the ground. And I just remembered that it was exactly 1 year ago today, October 16th, I was packing up my sleeping bag, two coats, granola bars and things going to the ISIS front line in Mosul. This time last year, I was in the outskirts of Mosul, joining the Kurdish forces, launching the first major offensive against ISIS in order to facilitate the way for the Iraqi army to enter Mosul. And now this is how the Kurds are paid back.
For you personally, Ayub, what would independence mean? And why, after being in Kurdistan less than a fortnight ago, you're rushing back to kind of bear witness to what happens next?
Because I believe this is a historical moment. It's a sad moment. It's a dark moment for Kurdish politics and Iraq as a whole. But independence would enable the Kurds to be part of the international community and live with dignity. But I still hope that independence does not come with violence, because the Kurds have seen a lot of violence, hardship, and suffering. And I've come up to this reality that no independence or no city, no territory, no oil well is worth a human life. I've seen so much of it in Iraq as a reporter, and then before growing up in Iraq, I think a human life, human blood is more important than anything else.
Do you think you'll see independence in your lifetime?
It was very close. I think last month and until a few days ago, millions of Kurds thought we were going to see it in our lifetime. But now it seems that not back to square one. I believe the Kurds in Iraq are back to even zero. It's beyond worse than square one. And God knows how long it is going to take for another generation of leaders, another generation of people to grow up and fight for independence, to see it or not to see it. Because if things are going the way they are going today in Iraq and has been going for decades, it is really hard to tell whether I will see independence in my lifetime or not.
The Kurds have had support from the United States since the 1990s. What do you think the Kurds want from the U.S. now? Or have you given up on the U.S.?
The Kurds have always known that the United States has not been a sincere friend. Okay, in 1975, in 1991, for a while, they abandoned the Kurds, and today again. So to answer your question, millions of Kurds are disappointed today with the international community, especially with the United States, because the Kurds have been allies of the United States since 1991 in every major project the U.S. has had in the region.
Ayub Nouri, English language editor with the Kurdish news service Rudal, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Our team that was on the ground in Puerto Rico said that after the hurricane, the countryside there had been stripped of so much greenery, it now looks like a petrified forest. That's the visual impact, but the first way we measure the scope of any hurricane or any disaster is the death toll. 2 weeks after Hurricane Maria, the death toll in Puerto Rico sat at 16. Now, 3 weeks later, it's risen to 48. And yet, all the reporting suggests that number could even be much higher. When the news site Vox dug into the numbers, they found that the death toll was probably closer to 450. And their report has now prompted two members of Congress to request an audit of how many people died in Puerto Rico. Eliza Barkley was one of the Vox reporters looking into this massive discrepancy. Let's first talk about the official death toll, Eliza. How have officials in Puerto Rico conducted the body count up to this point?
Well, we don't have a super clear sense of exactly how they've been doing it. But basically, one thing they've been doing is requiring that every single body be inspected by officials from the Institute for Forensic Science. And then they're also saying that they need to do interviews with family members to confirm that a death definitely, you know, resulted from the hurricane. So it seems at least like a pretty strict set of requirements in order to attribute a death directly to the storm.
Why did Vox start digging into these numbers, and how did you come up with the estimate that 450 people had died?
So as you noted, the death toll was stuck at 16 for a couple weeks. And then President Trump went to Puerto Rico and he cited that number of 16 as evidence that the response to the Puerto Rico disaster had been a success. And we knew from reports on the ground, investigative journalists who've also been looking into this, that this was very likely way too low of a number. So we decided to basically go through and look at all the Spanish and English news sources we could find, and we compiled our own numbers based on those reports. We found a total of 81 deaths linked indirectly or directly to the hurricane. That included what at the time of our report was 45 official deaths, and then there was another 36 that we found that were not showing up in that official count. And then we found another 450 reported deaths and another 69 missing. But, you know, I consider these to be squishy numbers. They're not hard evidence that this many people died after the hurricane, but they indicate that there's probably a lot of deaths out there that they're not accounting for in San Juan.
Well, one disaster researcher you spoke with said that the protocol for fatalities that you mentioned, in which every death must be confirmed by a medical examiner, is a process that inevitably will come up with the smallest number. Why do you think the process has been one which lowballs the number? I mean, one might guess that perhaps it's because they want to show that the storm isn't that bad.
Yeah, I mean, I agree it's a reasonable guess. It seems that they're exercising an abundance of caution. One thing I will say is that I've been talking to officials in Texas, trying to understand their process for attributing deaths to Harvey. And they also have a slow process, but at least they were updating it every day. You know, we respect the government's desire to be diligent and careful, but it seems like they could be communicating the death toll perhaps in a different way by saying, you know, we expect it to be in the hundreds, but for now it's 45. You know, maybe something like that would be more helpful in a moment like this.
One thing that struck me is you say that there are no federal or state guidelines for determining official body counts after a storm. I mean, how is that possible?
It turns out that the field of disaster epidemiology is not as well developed as one might think. You know, when I started looking into this, I expected that there would be a very sort of set way of coming up with these figures in these events because, as we know, they're so important for communicating the impact of a disaster. And yet it seems that it's done differently everywhere. The way the Puerto Ricans are doing it is extremely different from how it was done in Texas. John Mutter, the disaster expert I spoke to in Colombia, he said that the best way to do this is to do some simple math. Figure out the exact number of people who on average die in this period of time in past years. And then you'd want to compare that against the number of people who have died since the storm. Problem is, I just don't think we even know how many people have died since the storm. Like, that's the basic number that's missing still from the calculation. It's going to take a very, very long time to get a really clear sense. But I do think our reporting at least helped to bring attention to the need for a accurate death toll.
Eliza Barkley, a reporter with Vox, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Marco. Appreciate it.
Many Puerto Ricans are grappling with whether to stay on the island or leave. Our Across Women's Lives team was in Puerto Rico recently and spoke with a number of people about that. Check out our story at PRI.org. We've heard a lot recently about the rise of the far right in Europe, and the outcome of Austria's general election of the weekend seems to fit that trend. Here's how my BBC colleague Bethany Bell in Vienna sums up the results.
The Conservative People's Party, which is a kind of centre-rightist group, actually won the election. They got about 31%. Next, at about almost 27%, were the centre-left Social Democrats. And then, in a very close third, was the far-right Freedom Party at 26%. And that's without all the postal votes being counted, but that's roughly what the final result will be. So it seems that in this particular election, Austria has shifted to the right because there was a good result for the conservatives and for the far right.
Tell us more about the Freedom Party. I mean, could they still get into office if they form a coalition with the People's Party? And is that likely to happen?
It's looking increasingly likely to happen. The head of the Conservatives, whose job it will be to try and form the next coalition government, says at the moment he's trying to keep all his options open. And he may take a gamble and go into a coalition with the far-right Freedom Party. That would be quite controversial. But what they do have in common, and what they've increasingly had in common over this election campaign, is that they've both taken a very strong line against illegal migration. That was traditionally something that the far-right has really scored points on, especially since the migrant crisis of 2015 and 16, because Austria was one of the countries which took in tens of thousands of asylum seekers coming up from Turkey through the Balkan route. And that left a scar here. A lot of people were very concerned about that. And the head of the Conservatives thought, I can see that the far-right party is scoring points on that. I'm going to go that way as well. And he took this very strong line saying, I want to stop illegal migration. And he used softer language than the far-right did, but the message was very similar.
And how did that go over, do you think? Was it effective?
It was effective. It won him a lot of votes, we think, in terms of this election. And some analysts here say, you know, now it's harder to see where the boundary is between the right and the very far right, that it's becoming a bit more blurred. Others will say, no, actually what we've seen here is that we've had a young, popular conservative politician who's beat the far right at its own game.
My BBC colleague Bethany Bell speaking with us from Vienna. Thank you very much, Bethany.
Thank you.
Let's face it, sometimes it feels like history is stuck on repeat. Think of North Korea, a country that's been at odds with the U.S. since the time of Harry S. Truman. President Truman himself once said, wisely, the only thing new in the world is a history you don't know. Clifton Truman Daniel has a special appreciation for that. He's an amateur actor and Truman's eldest grandson. And now he's playing his grandfather on stage. He spoke with the world's Daniel Gross.
Almost every morning for months, Clifton Truman Daniel has poured himself some coffee, read the news, and then opened the pages of a 1975 script, Give 'em Hell, Harry, by Samuel Gallew. Its main character is Harry S. Truman. Daniel had to memorize 82 pages of monologue.
I caught myself imitating Harry Truman while mowing the lawn last week. And it's an electric mower, so I know my neighbors can hear me spouting this while walking back. They probably think I've lost my mind.
Growing up, Daniel hated when people called him President Truman's grandson instead of Clifton Daniel. But over the years, he met other presidential descendants, and he started to enjoy learning and preserving history.
You're living in someone's shadow. You try and do with it what you can on your own. You know, you try and find yourself in all of this.
Recently, Daniel told friends about his plan to play Truman at Thalian Hall in North Carolina.
And Margaret Hoover, Herbert Hoover's great-granddaughter, said, yes, you should totally do that.
Daniel first got the idea a couple years ago. As he approached 60, people started saying that he looked and sounded like Truman. But what started as a whim now seems timely, even urgent. Daniel started to notice uncomfortable similarities between the headlines and his lines in the play. For example, in August, when President Trump blamed both sides for white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, Daniel was learning lines about Truman's flirtation with the Ku Klux Klan.
In 1924, he was up for re-election as Eastern Judge of Jackson County, and the Klan wanted him to join, and he considered it.
Truman gave a friend $10 for the KKK initiation fee, but then he changed his mind and asked for the money back. The historical echoes don't end there. Tensions with North Korea have flared up under Trump, but they began under Truman. And Daniel was amazed to learn that Truman once warned Americans about rising income inequality.
He stood up in the Senate in 1937. He said one of the great problems facing this country is that we worship wealth over honor. A billionaire is greater in the eyes of the people than a public servant who works for the public interest. 1937, and here we are, 2017.
Truman died when Daniel was 15, which means he's trying to imitate the grandfather he knew and the president he knows about.
For me, the best way to get it is just to put on the headphones and let it play in my head over and over and over again.
People still ask me how I felt when I learned that President Roosevelt had passed away and that I had become the President of the United States.
That's a recording of Truman in 1964. Here's Daniel reciting lines from the play.
I never saw myself as president. I was just in the right place at the wrong time. Lots of folks could do a better job, but it became mine to do, and as long as you put me here, you'll get the best I've got. I've always thought of myself as an ordinary man. I don't have any special personal endowments. I don't waste time worrying about what I don't have.
How do you feel hearing yourself?
Not bad. You're making me nervous, but not bad.
Daniel aims to preserve his grandfather's legacy, but he also wants to harness it in new ways. Truman ordered the only wartime nuclear strike in history. Daniel became an anti-nuclear activist. In the play, the ghost of President Roosevelt asks Truman whether he regrets using nuclear weapons.
And he doesn't answer that. He just goes on to say, but I'd make the same decision. I think I'm probably going to nod. I mean, I can't add anything to the script. But he did have regrets.
Without rewriting history, Daniel hopes he can show the complexity of his grandfather's decisions. Before I leave, he combs his hair to one side and puts on clear plastic glasses. Then he looks at himself in the mirror.
So I've sent people pictures of me like this. It's a little spooky. There he is. Sort of.
Daniel used to feel like he was stuck in President Truman's shadow. This month, he gets to share the spotlight with his grandfather. For The World, Daniel Gross, Chicago.
That's where we leave it today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.